I didn't bring a gavel.
Yeah, you need to get a gavel.
Okay, duly noted.
And a little gavel.
So, good morning, everyone. I'm leading this meeting. I'm welcoming you. I'm Walla Walla County Commissioner Jim Johnson. I represent the Association of Counties as a commissioner on the commission. I'm going to pass around the sign-in sheet. For those who haven't done it, please do so. And let's go around the room and introduce ourselves. So we'll start with the table, and then we'll move to the back. So I'll go to my left here.
Jeff Sass, Washington State Patrol, filling in for John Batiste, Chief.
George Steele, representing the District Municipal Court Judges Association.
Good morning, Teresa Brunson, Director of Department of Licensing.
Glenn Gorton, filling in for Superintendent Reichdahl for the Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction.
Jerry Nelson with the Traffic Safety Commission.
Darren Rundell, Traffic Safety Commission.
Sony Helen with the Governor's Policy Office.
John Nesbitt, Department of Transportation. I'm here on behalf of Secretary Millar.
We'll start in that corner.
I'm Rainbow Sims-Jones, Traffic Safety Commission.
Kathy Cody, Office of Financial Management.
Good morning, Wes Rethwell, Lewis County Sheriff's Office.
Rob Snow from Lewis County Sheriff's Office.
Good morning, I'm Jennifer Cook with AAA Washington.
Good morning, Billy Reamer, now with the Healthcare Authority.
David Weed, Department of Health.
Debbie Besser, Traffic Safety Commission.
Blair Lonson, Traffic Safety Commission.
Ann Pankow, Traffic Safety Commission.
Bob Thompson, Traffic Safety Commission.
Mark McDowell, Traffic Safety Commission.
Bo Persh, Popular Department of Licensing.
Hai Ping Zhang, Department of Licensing.
Annika Esqueda, Traffic Safety Commission.
Shelley Baldwin, Traffic Safety Commission.
Jesse Knudsen, Thurston County Prosecuting Attorney's Office.
I'm Catherine Boyd, I'm the Target Zero Project Manager.
Very good. And
Tammy?
And
Tammy Barr, Fiscal Analyst.
Thank you.
WTSE.
All right. Do we have a quorum?
We do not.
Okay.
We're too shy.
Bummer.
Yes, it is.
Okay. I also want to introduce who already introduced himself. Wade Alonzo, who's the new Traffic Safety Commission Program Director.
Correct, yeah.
Welcome, Wade. He takes the place of, I suppose it's pretty hard to take his place, right? Mike Gable.
Yes.
Who retired, so we want to welcome him. I guess we can't actually approve the minutes. We'll have to move that to the next meeting, or hopefully we will have a quorum, or maybe some folks will show up late, you know.
Also, if we could just maybe have Teresa do a little intro.
Absolutely.
Hi.
Our new member.
Yeah, thank you so much. So, Teresa Burnson, Director of Department of Licensing. This is week three for me in the role. Prior to this, I was Director of the Office of Minority and Women's Business Enterprise. And prior to that, I was the Deputy Director of the Department of Licensing for about 4.5 years. So, it's kind of like coming home. So, it's a privilege to be back with this organization. Very important work. So, thank you.
Thank you. Welcome. Next on the agenda is the 2019 legislative session, and Shelley.
So I'm going to go real quick so we have enough time for Bo to talk about some legislation that we're crafting together. But I did want to let you know that you're aware that we had the Pedestrian Safety Advisory Council by legislation given to us to run, and the Bicycle Safety Advisory Council. And they're both ready to sunset this year. So the councils are both making a recommendation that we combine the councils for some cost savings and continue meeting, although they've been meeting monthly, so we're going to drop those meetings down to, 8 a year. Three meetings for the pedestrian, three meetings for the bicycle, and two meetings that would be joint bicycle and pedestrian meetings. So that they can work together on their recommendations, watch for the crossover on where those things run together. And we're super excited about it. It means that we'll be putting together a request that'll go to the governor's office and to the legislature by August, because that's when we need to let people know about any... that's what the legislation says this council has to do if it has a budget impact. But we are hoping for cost savings, so hopefully that'll be a happy place for it to go. So that's all I really wanted to talk about today, and I will make sure sure we have time for the next presentation. Are there any questions about the Bike and Ped Council? I think when they combine, they might become the Active Transportation Council. So.
Did you really say happy place and legislature in the same?
I'm an optimist.
I love your optimism.
This is a happy place.
It is a happy place.
No question. If I could just share the bicycle and the pedestrian advisory councils have been they're very well attended. Lots of good information. They broke out some of the priorities. You can have a one year, 2 year, third year. And so it's just seeing what kind of support and leverage we can get as far as resources and that from the legislature to support some of those programs. So we've had, what's the representative from Vancouver that was the one for bicycle?
Not Vancouver.
Clova?
Clova, North Seattle.
Yes, she has actually been in attendance to several of those meetings. So that's been really, I think, very helpful to have that interjection, so being there. So anyways,
very good. So DOL's Target Zero Bill, Bo.
Yes, where should I sit?
You can sit there, okay. Or you can stand up here.
And either maybe way. If I could key through the presentation, that would be.
Yeah.
Or you can sit right here.
There's a screen.
Is it
ready to go
here? So.
The lights just off. Just need to turn the light on.
So we just need to press power on the thing.
Is that this thing?
No, it's this.
I don't want to screw it up.
Yeah. It's not the power. The power's on. It's just the light is off.
Did you pay the power bill? Do we have enough power?
We can only afford half a bank.
Half a life.
Need to get new mice in the wheel.
Oh, no worries.
Debbie, I don't think it doesn't sound like it's on.
The blue lights are on.
Yeah, it's on.
Sorry, we haven't had this.
They have the PowerPoint in the package if you want to go ahead and get started.
I just keep working on it. So hopefully at least some of you in the room have it in your packets. Traffic Safety Commission put on an excellent traffic safety conference this March. It was my first time attending one of those. I found a lot of the data that our staff and others presented extremely compelling about Target Zero and what we're seeing and our progress towards it. And so kind of my ask of our staff after that was take all this data we've done and let's put it together in one presentation we can share with other folks about what we're seeing and areas we might be able to take on legislation or something else to help move these numbers in the right direction. If there are any actual hard technical questions, I have Hai Ping here. She's our research director. She's excellent, and so I'm going to defer her on any of those technical questions. But if you look at the first slide, you'll see here at our traffic fatalities, the numbers are going in the wrong direction. And then they've been going in the wrong direction since 2014. We've seen an increase in traffic fatalities has consistently been going up. And that makes it increasingly unlikely that we'll be able to reach our goal of zero traffic fatalities by 2030. Oh, this is looking promising. Mm-hmm. Kind of my goal in sort of presenting this and some of the kind of legislative options we're considering is how do we make those numbers move in the right direction, right? Here we go. Okay. So I just get to the slideshow button. I got it. Okay.
Sorry about that.
All right. So this was that graph I wanted to show you, right? A picture's worth 1,000 words. That tells the story pretty well. We are not on a good path to reach Target Zero. And if you look at our results, Washington measures related to Target Zero, we're off target on every one of them, both in terms of just total traffic fatalities, alcohol or drug involved, speed-related, and young drivers. You can see speed-related is probably the one that's the least You know, it's only 3% above target, while the other ones are hovering in that 30% range above targets. And so we try to target at least some ideas that we know that there are some legislative interest in that are addressing some of those, particularly young drivers. So when you look at the fatalities in Washington compared to the United States and other countries, you know, Washington's consistently done better than the United States as a whole. And we've, for a long time, been in this sort of pack of Canada and other Western European countries. You know, the UK seems to have one that's substantially below even that pack, but we've kind of hovered in that area. Recently, we started to pull away from that group. And as you see, the United States as a whole has also seen this increase, which is a troubling trend. We want that to continue to be moving downward. And so trying to look at ideas, how can we move the needle here and try to get back into that sort of cohort of Canada, other Western European countries that have lower rates. So the first area that I wanted to focus on is young drivers specifically and some of the ideas we have around this. So when you look at young drivers, they have some of the highest rates for collisions as a whole and also for fatalities. And so I think when we talk about ways that we can drive progress in the area, I think young drivers is somewhere we want to put a lot of our thinking and energy around. You can see in terms of injury crashes, the younger you are, the more statistically likely you are to be involved in one of these. But when we look at fatalities, interestingly enough, the 18 to 20-year-old segment is actually statistically more likely to be in a fatality than that younger group, right? And so maybe there's something there with that 18 to 20-year-old sort of cohort that we can do to help drive those numbers down. So when our team looked at the data, we found something fairly compelling here. That if you look at folks that have had driver training versus those that haven't, you see a statistically significant increase in the number of fatalities for those in that 18 to 19-year-old group. You know, they're almost twice as likely to have a fatality if they didn't take driver's ed versus those that did. And what's interesting is under current law, as soon as you turn 18, you don't have to take driver's ed anymore. There's not the graduated license program. You can just pass your written and pass your knowledge and pass your knowledge test and your drive test, and you can get a full license just like that. As if, you know, someone magically becomes a great driver on their 18th birthday, right? And when we look at young drivers as a whole, they tend to be at fault in accidents 70% of the time. So they are not just sort of, you know, these things are not just happening to them, they are causing these accidents most of the time. And I guess the only other thing I'd add is that 18 and 19-year-old group, you know, they're even more likely to be involved in a fatality collision than those that are even those younger drivers, the 16 and 17-year-olds. So I think that, you know, to me that tells a fairly compelling story about, you know, some options and opportunities we have in the state to help, you know, address some of those numbers. So when we dig into it even more, looking at the fatal collisions involving novice drivers, less than 18 to 19 years old, you can see that there's a really significant reduction for those that had driver training versus those that didn't. And when you look at those that even were involved in those fatalities, some of them weren't even at fault, right? Which that's true for the other group as well, but that's, to me, that is a fairly significant reduction that we're seeing here when you look at the actual numbers of folks that were involved in these fatalities. Okay, so the next piece I want to talk about is the graduated driver's licensing program. And because I have a little bit less time, I didn't go into a ton of the background. I wanted to focus more on some of the global best practices around this area and sort of where Washington stacks up. So you can see, there's a lot of different ideas on here for how you can improve traffic safety. Not all of these require legislation, I'll add. Some of these the department's already working on internally with the authority we do have, but looking at ideas like minimum age of 16 to get a permit, more practice hours, you'll see the one that we do have there is knowledge test, vision test, parental consent for underage 18. You see some things like should we apply these GDL requirements to all drivers, regardless of age? So the idea that a new driver is a new driver, right? And that is not currently how we do it in Washington State. So, like I said, many of options here. Right now, we only have one of those that we're doing in Washington. Similarly, for the intermediate stage, we do have the no electronic device use. I think that, you know, that's a sort of important change we had made. But there are a lot of other sort of areas that we could potentially look at. So the idea that nighttime driving restrictions. Right now we have, I think, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. But when they look at the crash data, I think that 60% of those crashes are between that 9 p.m. to, I think it was, 11 p.m. And so we're not really capturing that segment when we're seeing a lot of that happen. Now, I've pitched a lot of these ideas to legislators before, and there's always concerns about, you know, I live in a rural area, my kid needs to get around to school, to extracurricular activities, to work. So we've talked about, you know, well, what are some options to have, you know, exceptions for certain purposes. But, you know, a variety of these that sort of we've discussed with others about, you know, pros and cons, because they do impact people's lives. I'll give you another example, the idea of needing a clean driving record to graduate to full licensure. So, you know, you have to make it through this period of having an intermediate license, and if you, you know, go through that without any, you know, tickets or anything like that, you can then get your full license. So, just to give that awareness, like I said, there's, we could spend a lot of time talking about each one of these, but just to give a sense that there's still plenty of things we as a state could do, I think, to help move our numbers even more in the right direction. Third piece that I want to just raise as sort of the item for consideration is this idea of administrative suspensions. So right now, if someone is charged with a DUI, the Department of Licensing can administratively suspend their license. And then, you know, when then, so we don't have to wait until they're convicted. Well, sometimes in the court system that can be a year or so later. And so the idea that we're just sort of exploring is, does it make sense maybe in some other cases of serious offenses to expand that? So this is a real situation that happened. You had a 16-year-old driving under a permit, racing 90 plus miles an hour, killed an individual, vehicular homicide. That person took their driving test, they were issued a license, and so they continued to drive for a pretty long period of time, and then when that conviction finally came through and we were notified by the courts, we suspended their license. The idea being, you know, does it make sense for certain serious offenses where there's a relatively small case number to treat those, you know, that same way? Now, this is a somewhat controversial issue because there are a lot of questions about due process here. Unlike DUIs, we don't have a BAC test that we can administer to determine fault. There's a lot more sort of investigative fact-finding that has to go into that. So are we denying people that due process? But I just raise it as something to consider, to think about, that that is what current law is. This gives you a sense of some of these violations that may fit into this camp of where we might consider an administrative suspension. As you can see, the case number is relatively low, but you've got things like vehicular assault involving alcohol, homicide, hit and run involving fatality, racing, some of these other ones. Okay, so third piece, motorcycles. So looking at this, motorcycle fatalities have been flat for 13 years. We've seen really no reduction here, which is, you know, that's not the trend we want to see, right? We want to see these fatalities going down over time. And what can we do as a state to sort of help move that forward? Because when we look at the data on motorcycles, what we see is that motorcycle riders are at fault most of the time, right? 75% of the time, motorcycle riders are at fault, and this is for fatalities, and that tends to change as they get older, to be fair, but it's extremely true for your new riders. I mean, you're looking at like 95% here for that 18 to 29 group, and it stays high until you get up into that, you know, 60 to sort of over 70 when that sort of starts to change a little bit. But so you take that, though, combined with this interesting information. This one's a little bit hard to understand without the explanation, but what you can see is that riders across the number of years of experience continue to think that the other driver is the reason. So what's the greatest risk to you? It's the other driver. And that does not track with the actual data that shows they are at fault 75% of the time as a whole, and much higher rates for the younger motorcycle drivers. But as we can see, even for those that have, you know, for been riding, just a year versus more than 20 years, it still is pretty consistent that, you know, a majority of them, most of the time at least, think, yes, the other rider is the issue here. So clearly there's some kind of disconnect going on about, you know, who's sort of causing these accidents, who's at fault. All right, so this is the one where I'm hoping we can kind of have a good discussion here, your thoughts, because the department is still considering what ideas, if any, we want to bring forward as a Traffic Zero bill. We've been working closely with Traffic Safety Commission and the State Patrol on these concepts. But as you can imagine, our ideas, we want to inform our policy ideas with the data. And so they're focused around some of these things we've discussed today. First piece is around regulating novice drivers. And sort of one of the big centerpieces on this is the idea of driver training for all. You're not magically a good driver when you turn 18. It takes training. It's like any skill in life. You need to practice. You need to have training on that. Some of the issues, though, that come up around this is the cost and access to it. So when I talk to legislators, rural access is something that comes up as we've moved driver training out of the public schools and into the private sector. Sometimes they may not have a good market for driver training in some of these areas because there's not enough people. So one idea that we were considering to help expand that access is allowing driver training online. That's something that other states have offered. I'd say generally in society there's this increased push to have online options for education. Of course, they're still having to do the practice hours. They're still having to take the drive test. But it is helping with that access issue, and we also think it may put some competitive pressure on the price of driver training because you're bringing more actors into the environment, more competition. Another one that's not on here that we're also working on potentially having in the package is the idea of a subsidy for low-income individuals, because we know driver training is about $300 or $600 depending on where you live. When we look at the data, we see that 75% of low-income people are waiting until they're 18 to get their license, while only 20% of high-income people are. So clearly, there's some, at least it appears to me, there's some linkage there, right, where the cost of having to go through that program is prohibitive for these folks, and then they're waiting. But they're also dying an increased number in fatalities. So, you know, could we establish some kind of pool where low-income individuals can get a subsidy for their driver training? How would you fund that? Maybe a fee on every driver's license transaction. Of course, fees, controversial, but trying to look at ways of how can we fund it? Trying to give options, right, for policymakers to consider. Some of the other ideas, expanding these sort of learner permit and intermediate license requirements to those that are over 18. Similar with the idea of you're not magically a good driver at 18. A new driver is a new driver, right? You should have these GDL requirements for a certain period of time as you're a newly licensed driver, regardless of whether you're 16 or you're 18. That's kind of the idea there. Some of the other ones, looking at maybe additional penalties for violations during the intermediate license stage, to try to incentivize good behavior during that sort of most dangerous time of being a new driver to get an injury, collision, or fatality. Increasing practice hours, 50 to 100, just more time that you need to practice. And then finally, like I had mentioned before, expanding those nighttime restrictions. So is 1 a.m. to 5 a.m., does that really capture these periods when we're actually seeing most of these fatalities? So what if we took it down to 9 or 10 p.m.? So that is the first piece. I think that's kind of one of the most significant ones that we're looking at as a sort of young driver. I'm happy to wait till the end for questions, but also want to have a good discussion here. Your thoughts, takeaways, your ideas? Go for it.
Well, first off, I think there'll be issues if you try to come up with an administrative suspension program for charges other than DUI type charges, because under the DUI, and again, from keeping a record, George Steele for the DMCJA, you're not losing your license administratively because you got a DUI. you're losing it because there is probable cause to believe that you were committed a DUI, and you had a breath test that was 0.08 or more. And I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
I always cause people's eyes to glaze, particularly my clients for years, when I give examples. But I once had a case where there were the husband and wife in the car. Wife was driving. They were arguing. She ran the car into an embankment. The only way to get out of the car was out of the driver's side. And witnesses saw her leave first, and she ran to her house. Okay? She calls the police and says that my client tried to kill her, and he was driving drunk. So the police show up, and they take her word for it, even though she's slamming quite a few down at that point. And I know this has never happened except this one time, but and the police make the decision, well, they're believing the wife, therefore they have their, what they consider probable cause to arrest the driver, arrest my person became my client. He's on the way to a jail, but on the way they stop, I think, at the Yelm Police Department to administer the breath test. They administer the breath test. He is over 0.08. Now he's being taken to the Pierce County Jail, which is where this occurred. At that point, the wife's conscience starts to kick in, and she calls up saying, look, I lied. He wasn't the driver. I was. And I had other witnesses in the DOL hearing that saw him exit the vehicle last, after she did, but they still suspended his license. It was pretty minimal due process. Now, but the point is, if there's probable cause to believe you're operating a motor vehicle under the influence, and you take the test, it's irrelevant as to whether in the end it turns out there's proof beyond a reasonable doubt or anything else. But I would think for most of these other things you're talking about, like reckless driving and all that to take place, you would actually have to have, you know, basically give up the presumption of innocence when you're talking about taking away a license. That is problematic.
And that has been our concern with the idea, exactly, is that is it giving enough due process?
It may also not survive a constitutional challenge. The other point, and like I said, I've looked at all the detailed change in licensing laws. The license I'm mostly concerned about in this day and age is my own. So, but I grew up in Colorado, and that's where I learned to drive. There, Colorado had a point system, and we had three levels of licenses. We had minor operator license. That minor operator license, you have 4 points. Then the next was a provisional operator's license, 8 points, and then that's from 18 to 21. At 21, you would get your adult operator's license, which had 12 points. For minor operator license in Colorado at the time, one speeding ticket 10 miles over would wipe your license out for a good period of time and suspend it. And that may be something to emulate here now. What is Colorado? I haven't been in Colorado in years and years, so they may have changed it. I guess I have a question. You said that numbers really started going in a very different way in 2014. We're talking right now, people underage or what have you, but is there anything that occurred in 2014 that you can pin it on or anything like that?
We've been asked that question before. It's a great one. I think, do you want to sort of give us a list where we're at? Shelley, I think whoever wants to take a crack at that one.
This is not just the Washington alone. This is actually nationwide, and there are so many researchers and try to nail down what caused this increase. There's a lot of different speculations, like the economy started going strong and the people drive more. When you have more exposure to drive, you have more. There's no very unified conclusion on that. Shelley, you want to add more?
In Washington specifically, so maybe not with the rest of the nation, even though we all went up, in Washington we saw a big increase in 2014 in distracted driving crashes, and that actually went up by 30%, whereas other items didn't go up by 30%. And the other corollary to that is that we're seeing this exponential increase in drivers who are positive for both alcohol and drugs, or multiple drugs, so this poly drug use piece. And that's very concerning. Can we pin it on marijuana legal stabilization, we're not ready to make that leap yet.
Well, I'm prepared to at least say that's one of the suspects, because I've heard that started, but they're with the distracted driving also. One of the things that just, and again, when I learned how to drive, I think my first car was a Stegosaurus, but that's another story. But my recollection of those days is you get your license, you're not sure of the car, it takes a little while to really get comfortable driving the car, you don't take chances. However, when you hit that age group, all of a sudden you still have immaturity and experience, but now a comfort in operating the motor vehicle. And I suspect that's probably why there's a spike in that age group, but they haven't taken studies. That's just a speculation on my part. As far as the education, I think that's a good idea. Maybe a possibility would be to, in those, instead of giving subsidies out, because that's just throwing money that people don't want just to be throwing out there, because in those particular counties where that's an issue, maybe look at working with schools in that area to help them fund a driver's ed program if there's not adequate private programs to go along with it.
So I have a question. Along that line, I took driver's ed in school, and my kids are old enough, so I think they all did too. When did driver's training leave the schools and become more privatized, and what was the impetus or the reason behind that?
2001, 2002, when all the funding was removed from the schools and that sort of thing. Yeah.
It still is in some schools, but we still
have a few.
So I wonder if maybe rather than subsidies for that, if we looked at just subsidizing driver's training in general, back associated with the school systems. I suppose you get a lot of pushback from all the private companies now that are out there doing it, but that's not really my problem, our problem, I guess. But it just seems to me that was a good system. It worked well.
Well, I think part of it was the legislation from last year that moved it all away from OSPI all over to DOL.
We still have the authority or the approval process and that, but the DOL now has the ability to look at our school districts and that. It's been from about 2002 until now, we have not had the funding in order to go into the school districts and audit them and see how they're doing. So this gave DOL the authority to go in and audit certain things.
You know, to create that parity between public and private programs.
Yep, yep.
Yeah. I'd like to say something. I'm from a rural county. I've been into every single school in our county. We're a lot into the kids out there, and you're talking about these 18 to 20-year-old kids. Recently, I have two kids that meet that age bracket, but I've taken them, taught them all both how to drive, and went through that process. It's very expensive. So when you see these young kids out there who want to drive, and mom and dad can barely afford to have one car, right, let alone insurance on their car, when we pulled out of the schools, this is what happens.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You can't kid yourself, because a lot of these would have been prevented had we stayed in the schools. And I'm not trying to preach about it. We just got to deal with the real hard facts. So we want to bring up legislation. We want to try to change it. But what it really comes down to is getting back in the schools, because now you can still educate an 18-year-old who was going to get his driver's license out of snow, but we're going to allow him now to take driver's education in the school and maybe help prevent him from being involved in these fatalities. And I just think that's where we need to go. And as far as this 9 a.m. or 9 p.m. and stuff, these kids between 18 and 20, they're getting out there because mom and dad are poor. They're trying to go work at McDonald's, and they have to work the late shift till 11 or 12, like my niece does or my daughter. And so it makes it very challenging. I've been to many fatalities with young teenagers, and what can we do differently? But making more legislation to try to fix a problem instead of actually saying, okay, where's the real problems? Let's invest our time in that. And I appreciate all this information. It's a lot of good stuff. But I think we pulled out of schools, and we really need to help those people that are indigent. And you can take, we got 39 counties. You can take, let's just take 15 out of the mix. You got the rest of the counties. there still have a lot of poor people out there struggling day to day to put meat on the, food on the table, let alone kids getting it driver's head.
I think you really hit the nail on the head.
Yeah.
Because I think it really goes back to the training, you know, the proper training, because all the restrictions for hours and things like that, I mean, they're almost not necessary if you get started on the right foot, you know, if you get the right training. And I have to agree. I mean, I think if we look at going back into schools, if we're going to spend some money somewhere, you know, equal opportunity, that's where we should do it, is in the schools.
But it also gives you the opportunity, if you're back in the schools, you're also going to be able to talk about all the other distracted driving and all the other things that we talk about.
Sure.
Everything that we're talking about here, now we have a captive audience who has to pay attention. We're giving them those opportunities, and maybe there's some funding through the schools or whatever you do, but this is a captive audience now. We've got them where we want them to be. You know, we can give them everything they want, but they're going to go out and do their own. But
it'll be easier to tie it into the Target Zero programs, the every 15-minute programs, things like that, I would think.
Do we have any idea how much money that would cost? How much was taken away?
How much does a fatality cost?
And there was still costs associated with taking driver's ed in high school.
Yes, there was, because only part of it was paid for, yes.
Yeah, you can pay part of it, and you can... There can be grants out there that we can offer for indigent families that are out there.
I mean, you can look at AAA and other organizations that I would think you could partner with that would help with that.
So I agree. I'm completely the cost of a fatality or a serious injury. I'm also thinking of the reality of the legislative process and the funding process. And so one things I'm debating in my head is, that is a calculus to make, and is there something that we should, or is it advisable to do in the meantime, if that is a more longer-term thing? That's one part of the equation.
And in the past, a lot of the funding that was received for that program came from citations and that sort of thing.
Hmm. Interesting. Okay.
Online driver education might be the answer to your question, is what can we do now? Because there are not just AAA, but there's other organizations out there that have proven driver education. It matches all the hours you need, all of the content that you need, and anybody can get to it from their computer, and by downloads, people have that in their homes or have access to it. I would also say I would love to at least get to that 18 to 21-year-old group with online driver education now, even if we can't get to the under 18 at this time.
Yeah, I believe we have a good system for those that are under 18, but we need something like that online for over 18. I don't know if it's going to work so good in the 16 to 18, but it's I think that would be a great system for over 18 that we could get started rather with much more expeditions.
It's obvious that what you're seeing is the folks that can't afford it are waiting.
Yep.
They're just waiting.
Yep.
They get that magic age, and boom, they get a license.
I just need some education. Because I'm trying to remember, if you're waiting until 18 to get your driver's license, when can you get your permit? Do you get a permit, or can you get your permit at 16, practice 2 years, and then get your driver's license
at 18? No permit needed if you're 18.
Just get your license.
Pass the test.
You just pass the test. There's
maybe that's a change you can do, too. That way they get 2 years of experience with an adult, maybe?
I just wanted to mention, when talking about bringing back the classes to high schools, I think something that we need to talk about is the quality of them. Where I come from, when I was in high school, there was a lot of talk about these classes being taught by the coach, and not that there's anything wrong with that, but at the time there was an issue that the coach was passing everybody. And so I think if that's something that we're reconsidering, and we're looking at prices and how much the impact's going to be money-wise, we need to take the quality in consideration.
And that was one of the reasons why we went with 1481, where we're having DOL doing the audits, because they're doing the audits on the privates already, and to keep the quality up within the school districts also.
That's right. Curriculum standards across the board are the same. We can audit to those.
Yeah,
that's right.
So I have just two questions.
the online program, as far as other jurisdictions that may be using them, do they have any data to see how it's actually working? Do they have similar crash rates or lower crash rates? I mean, it's the way the world's going now. I mean, we're getting degrees online, but I know that doesn't necessarily mean you're operating a vehicle.
No.
But we do similar, I think, Wade, with boating. You yes. can do your boating licensure all online and get a certificate. So, but I don't know if there's any data to show that maybe those that have received boating license, you know, the online training, and those that have not, that kind of thing, just as some a starting point to see that this isn't just, you know, just for driver's license. But and the reason I ask this is tying it right back into driver training for all new drivers, regardless of age, because we do have a lot of people that come in from out of country that have never driven before. And so it's how do we help them to protect their own families, themselves, and that through a driver training program? Because, you know, when I was working the road, a lot of times, you know, you had maybe first generations that were coming in that no one was able to teach them how to drive. And they were horrible. And so we thought they were DUIs most of the time. So I think is just this driver training for all new drivers, I think is something that it shouldn't just be for the 16-year-old. I think it should be for everybody. Mm-hmm. We require it for all CDLs, specifically at certain endorsement levels that they have to have certain additional training. Why not for all drivers?
I think it's a good idea to put the information out there. And frankly, when I'm driving, I can tell there's all sorts of people have no idea what the right-of-way rules are. Their idea of the right-of-way is they try to wave you through, even though they have a right-of-way, which is actually dangerous because then you're having to guess, you know, how long you're going to wait for you, what have we have these rules for a reason. But I would tend to think, and again, I don't have any data for this, this is just a hunch on my part, that the real thing that's lacking is basically behind-the-wheel time and learning how to. It's kind of like I went to law school. Yeah, a long time ago, dinosaurs for 1 year. And learned all sorts of concepts and everything like that. But as far as my learning how to be a lawyer, really got started in May of 1982 when I got when I was a legal intern with the Pierce County Prosecutor's Office. And that's where I learned how to try cases, how to make motions, what the pleadings are supposed to look like, things like that. And I think it's similar to driving. So just putting information online, if I wanted to, I'd go on YouTube and I could pull up a video, how to start a 737. But you wouldn't want me bugging. If you were flying somewhere, you would not want me in that cockpit. So I think it needs to include that.
Yeah, and that's what I think is you know, can you do the actual coursework online, but then the requirement is that they go through some type of a driver school for their actual hands-on practical
right.
driving.
Yep, part. We would still have that. I wouldn't get it.
Exactly. So do we have data on, you know, all new drivers by age and then kind of their crash risk as well? Was that on there or was it just...
Your injury fatalities by Idaho. So in Idaho right now, online driver education is legal.
Okay.
Approved. So they can take the online driver education in substitution of their classroom piece of it, but they do have to go to a driving school, private, and they do have public there to do their behind the wheel part of it. So they're not getting out of doing that part.
Yeah,
that's
not taking place on.
So one of the I think something, obviously, this is going to take some time to develop some legislation that's going to change fundamentally how we do this. In the meantime, I think it's important that we look to start educating our legislators now about the problem. To present this kind of data to our legislators to say, look, you know, obviously we made some wrong turns here, and this is what's happening, you know, and it's costing lives.
so that they're aware of this before we, before the first time they sit in a subcommittee meeting where we present them with some new legislation. We need to do some ongoing education. And frankly, through the, I represent the Association of Counties. I mean, I think that would be a good avenue. We have great relationships, for the most part, with our legislators. But you know, it's but we're talking to them all the time, and I think probably many of us are in the course of our work. So I would like to see us get some of this information in a kind of a concise report that we can say, you know, this is something the Traffic Safety Commission and others. Stakeholders are looking at it needs to change, and here's why, and just get it on their radar.
I completely agree. We've been meeting with legislators and giving them, you know, and explaining the data and talking with them. I've talked about getting on a work session for committee days or beginning a session for both transportation committees to present some of the data. So I 100% agree, and I think to the extent we can leverage partners, Phyllis, if not say, you know, here's legislation we want you to do, at least this is what the data is showing us about crashes. Well said.
So I think it would also be good to include the education committee members as well, yes. Given the conversation yes. today. Yes. There's a lot of talk about the need to have this back in school, so making sure that they understand this issue might be helpful as well.
Most definitely.
Very good. Yeah.
Shelley.
Just before we leave, I think it's really important to point out that the recommendations around the intermediate driver's license are not just draconian, let's punish them and limit their driving. They really have been studied, and these are the best recommended practices for intermediate driver's license. So when we talk about moving that restricted time up to 8 or 9, and even if we're talking about going to 20-year-olds, the legislation itself can have a lot of exemptions to it. So you can say, you're working, no problem. We have to remember that intermediate driver's license is not a primary stop. You have to be stopped for something else before they're going to find those things. And you can, the law will allow you to say whatever exemptions you want to put into it. Having that as an option in the law actually reduces the number of fatalities. So before we get wrapped around, we don't want to limit the number of passengers or the number of hours. I just really want us to look at the research that's out there that says these things will prevent deaths in young drivers before we dismiss them.
So one other question about the data. You went to the slide that showed the fatalities by age group, but are you able to drill down to determine of those fatalities how many were new drivers? So if the question is...
How long they've been licensed.
Right, because I think one of the questions I heard is that we're not just talking about young drivers, that mm-hmm. that this could be an issue for all drivers. Mm-hmm. But then if the numbers are just the age group, but it doesn't differentiate between new drivers and drivers who have theirs, I think it'd be interesting to see if we see that kind of consistency yeah. with all new drivers. Is this an issue of young drivers, or is this an issue of new drivers?
We did look into that. For the 18, 19 years old, there's a day and night difference between the old, licensed earlier and the brand new license at 18. We have that data.
So maybe we can get that.
Yeah. So for the other age groups, like if mm-hmm. for the because at the 25 group, I think it was, it dropped down pretty significantly. Is it 26 to 29 drop
yeah,
down?
Yeah, we see a drop in fatalities yeah. at least.
So I'm just wondering, do you have many people that are new drivers, and what is the proportion of right. that?
For age 18, we have about 15,000 a year new drivers, and 19 is a little less. And after 21, it's 5,000 a year, so it's in the level at that. So your primary new drivers is 18. Other than 16-17.
And then looking at not just the total number, but proportions, I think that's the question I'm asking, is the proportion of new drivers that are involved in these accidents versus the total number. Does that make
yes.
sense?
We do have that. I just can't remember it. The top line has the exact number, the new versus.
Oh, we can put something together with that slide.
Because I think that goes to the question of whether these restrictions should just be for young people,
right,
or whether it should be for all new drivers, if you can get data to show what the proportions are.
I just want to add to the conversation a little bit about the other thing that's happening there is the brain development is completing around age 25, and people are now rationalizing their behaviors better.
Yeah.
And so with somebody from a behavioral health background, I would guesstimate that we're going to see fewer of those after age 25. I would also caution, as a former educator, I think we ask schools to do everything and remind people that youth spend less than 25% of their waking hours in schools and the rest of communities. So I think it is great for them to support that and is a captive audience. But I think we have this perception that kids are always in school, and they aren't. They're always in communities, and schools exist in communities. And so think broader about what that is. And so I think in addition to the piece on education, I think what you guys are describing and wanting for education is just simply the social development strategy, and they need knowledge, skills, and opportunities to apply the two. And I think it would be great if we want to propose something to have a work group that specializes in that kind of thing come together and make a proposal for the best way to achieve those three components to get behaviors to shift.
So you're saying at 25 the brain is coming on, and then at 80 it's going away.
Not to comment on it's any after 25.
So I just wanted to add to what Shelley said. AAA has the foundation that does our research has really looked at a lot of the nighttime restrictions, passengers, etc. So we do have study research information that I can provide to everybody on some of those topics. And I would say the one that kind of floats to the top for us is that when we looked at crashes, and not keep in mind too that these crashes that we're looking at here are the most severe crashes, so we're not talking about the normal fender benders where maybe somebody wasn't in critical when they went when they left the scene. So we looked at actual crashes that were not a part of this category of 16 and 17 year old drivers video in the car, and we found that despite what we may all think, passengers were a much bigger distraction than their phones were. So in about 15% of the crashes, passenger was the distraction. And we found by adding one passenger that was under 20 to a car with a teen driver, 16, 17 years old, it increased their crash risk by 44%. You add two, it's 50%, and then four, it quadruples that number. So I think passenger restrictions, I know for AAA is kind of top of the list. Obviously, nighttime restrictions, I think we can have a lot of exemptions for working and school activities, but I know that water gets pretty muddy quickly.
All right, well, we need to move along. Good information. Obviously, we're gonna be doing a lot more about this, and maybe what we really need to do is in the future maybe schedule a workshop that concentrates, you know, on this.
There's a lot to discuss.
There is.
Yep. And, this is great.
Absolutely appreciate the work and the information. Thanks, Bo.
Oh, yeah.
And Shelley and others. So moving right along, thanks, Target Zero updates. Catherine.
Hi. So I see you might be a little bit behind on the schedule. I can do an abbreviated version of this presentation. If folks like, that would probably take 5 to 10 minutes. If I did the whole presentation, it would be probably 15 minutes, and then I'm sure there would be questions that would lengthen it. So do folks have a preference?
What's the pleasure of the group? Is anyone under a real difficult time constraint here? Let's go with the full presentation.
Okay. So I'm the project manager for the 2019 Target Zero. We formally began work around April 2019, and we actually have, that was basically the initiation of the project. We have a charter, we have started doing research, which I'm gonna talk about in a moment, and we have had the first two project team meetings. The project team is the group that substantially organizes and develops the project. And we have a schedule that's come out of that work that I wanted to share with you. In September and October, we're going to be getting the data together and beginning some writing. We're planning to have a partner meeting in December 2018. So, I believe, sign the agreement for the space for that, but that's our goal. Our intention is to have all the drafts completed in February of 2019, and the plan will go out for review in April. And then you'll see the copy in June, and in July, review and recommend it to the governor for adoption. So, and then the governor would adopt in July as well, we hope, and we publish in August. This is similar to the timeline we had in 2016. But the way this is set up now, the first time you would officially see the plan is in June 2019. And so one of my questions to you is, do you want to see, is there, are there folks around this table who would like to see preliminary versions of these chapters of the plan? When it goes out for public review, certainly that's an opportunity for everyone here to review it as well. We just want to make sure that we put you guys in a position where you can comfortably, you have enough time to comfortably review and recommend to the governor.
Any comments? Preferences?
I'd like to see the preliminary stuff.
Okay. So we have an opportunity in April when it goes out for public and tribal review. I can make sure the copies get to the commissioners.
That'd be good.
Does that give you enough time?
Sure. I think so.
Okay. All right. Hearing nothing else. I don't know. I'm going to usurp your role here.
No, no, please.
Okay. All right. So my plan will be to make sure that you get copies of the plan in April when it goes out for public tribal review, and that gives you a long lead time to review and give feedback, make sure that you're comfortable with what you'll eventually recommend for adoption. Another question for you, just in general, is there anything that you need from me or the project in general right now, ongoing throughout the project or later on in the project? I think I'll have the opportunity to make status updates at every presentation, so I won't be deliberately keeping you in the dark, but I won't be doing anything to reach out or especially in the interim. Most of you have representatives in the project team or in the steering committee, so those folks will be doing the work from your agencies and your constituents' perspectives.
Very good.
Okay, the next I want to talk about is a little bit of the research that we've done. So we did two types of research. One was a stakeholder interview. I was the person who did this, and I spoke to many people who are on our steering committee and our project team, folks who are fairly close and tight to the core group of the project. My colleague Jacqueline Gulp, who is my assistant project manager, did a user survey, and that was much wider ranging. It was much more peripheral partners, and we independently evaluated the results we got from those two research tools, and I wanted to present to you what we learned in that process in an abbreviated version, HiClip. So I spoke with 24 people in the course of this, and it was actually from April to July 2018. Someone slipped in at the last second there. And I also attended the Target Zero Manager meeting in June and got some feedback there. And this is kind of a distillation of the common themes that I heard. People who I spoke with wanted a focus on highlighting successful best practice programs and using that to make the document more actionable. So right now it has hundreds, if not thousands, of strategies in it. And these folks wanted to know, of those strategies, what can we do right now? What could I implement in my region or my state to make the biggest success? And how do I implement that? So some actionable information. I'm just planning to roll along, so if folks have questions, just raise your hand. I'm happy to take questions. I also heard an interest in focusing on the design element of engineering. This would be creating roads designs that are safer for non-motorized traffic, bicyclists, and pedestrians. The idea is that would trickle up to motor vehiclists. Those folks would be safer because the roads in general would be safer. And this would also take some of the weight off of enforcement, because the roads would become self-enforcing. If they naturally slowed down traffic, then you would need a police officer there to slow down the traffic. I heard interest, lots of focus on non-motorized traffic, and this includes newer vehicles like electric scooters and those little one wheels you might see people tooling around Seattle on. There's a couple people brought up to me that this group of sort of interim forms of transportation is growing. There's not a good name for it yet, but the best current slot we have for this is bicyclists, folks who are not walking but they're not in a car either. So So just something to think about as that group, that population of travelers grows. They move in different patterns than a bicyclist or a pedestrian. They have a low profile of a pedestrian often, but the speed of a bicyclist are even faster. So that can create unusual traffic patterns that most people are not familiar with. There was a strong openness to innovation, especially as the we're seeing a rise in the fatality and serious injury rate.